VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
Well, thank you for joining us on Crosstalk, coming your way from VCY America. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, massive change has evolved over the past several years in the area of healthcare, and one of those concerns is the implementation of electronic health records, EHRs. It was said that this was going to save time. It would save money. Has it? What impact have these EHRs, what impact is happening to doctors right now with them? What about patient privacy? Is this being impacted by the EHRs? Well, we're glad you've joined us today as we welcome back Twyla Bray. She's the president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. She's a registered nurse. She provides daily commentary on the Health Freedom Minute and also author of the soon-to-be-released Big Brother in the Exam Room, The Dangerous Truth About Electronic Health Records. Her site is cchfreedom.org. Twyla, thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Jim. Thank you.
Well, Twyla, for several years, you have been warning about electronic health records. And before we get into some of the concerns, because now those concerns have turned into reality, let's first of all talk about what these are. What is an electronic health record?
So it's not what people think. It is not just an electronic version of your medical record. It is so much more. So it not only has the data that is in a typical paper medical record, for instance, but it also has, billing information. It has other tracking information. It has data that are used for quality measures. There are certain, that's why you'll see the doctor or the nurse clicking. There are certain things that they have to click. It's used to report certain data for scoring the physicians, for tracking their care, for determining if they're being compliant with what the government wants them to be compliant with. There are embedded alerts that pop up and are causing alert fatigue that tell the doctors, oh, maybe with this patient, if you give them this medication, it'll, be a difficulty with that medication, or this patient hasn't had an immunization, maybe you should ask them if they want one. So the computer has, it's a computerized system that has all of these things that have been put into it. Treatment protocols, alerts, tracking, much more than is in the paper medical record.
Yeah, so much so that it's like this electronic device is becoming the diagnoser in the medical doctor itself.
That's kind of interesting because I was at a major health information technology conference about a month ago, and I listened to these different people talk about what they want the electronic health record to do. And there are people who would like to have algorithms spit out diagnoses and treatment protocols for the doctor to follow. And this one speaker said that they thought that the doctor always has to be in charge because there are things that the computers and algorithms do that even the technicians, the EHR, developers, they can't figure out why. And so they make errors, and they don't know why. And so these are people's lives that we're talking about, but yet there are many, many people out there planning to make a lot of money and to put these kind of algorithms in the computer to basically tell doctors what to do.
Well, let's break this down a little bit. Let's deal with the cost aspect first. And these EHRs, they were promoted, Twyla. This is going to bring huge cost savings to us. I noticed that there's been some information that's been brought forth that is anything but huge cost savings. What can you tell us about this so-called cost savings?
Yeah, well, there was a study from Harvard that just kind of reiterated the fact that the electronic health records, one of the things, one of the promises that had been made was that there was going to be all the savings. As a matter of fact, I believe the number was $80 billion in savings was projected before the Democrats in Congress and President Obama in the very in the first month after he was inaugurated, this bill got passed called the Recovery Act. And that mandated electronic health records unless the doctor was willing to take reduced payments from Medicare. And so the promise had been that the electronic health records were going to save all of this money. And therefore, that was just one of the reasons. It was the interesting thing about that is Obama's CBO director already had said those were like faulty numbers, that that wasn't going to happen. But nonetheless, that was the mandate that came down from the Democrat-led Congress and signed by President Obama and now is in place all over the country, these electronic health records in every hospital and every clinic. Or almost every clinic. But anyway, so there are going to be all these cost savings. And there's just a little study that came out of Harvard that said that, you know, even using the electronic health record, it still is going to cost $20 to $215 just to generate a bill.
Just to generate a bill?
Just to generate a bill.
But, you know, I also saw this Harvard Gazette reported that the billing costs were estimated at $100,000 per provider each year. And I'm sure, Twyla, all this, and the dollars you mentioned, all of that gets passed on to patients or insurance companies, and I thought so much for affordable health care.
Right. That is one thing in my research that I have, that will be in the book, is just to talk about all the different ways that the electronic health records are costing the American people, because it's costing the doctors, it's costing for them to research what kind of system to put in, to buy it, to train all the people, to keep it updated, to lease it, to pay every month to be on the cloud with someone if they don't want to buy their own internal system with a server. There are all of these costs. There are technical costs. There are re-upping costs, you know, paper and pen didn't require all these additional costs. It did require storage, but so does the electronic health record. You have to store all this information and you have to pay for that storage. So nothing about this is cheap. Congress gave in the Recovery Act basically about $30 billion, to get these things set up all around the country. But $30 billion doesn't even begin to cover the cost of what it has cost to do that.
No, and that's very interesting because I saw an article on The Hill. You just mentioned that dollar amount, and they reported in a story that the Obama administration set aside these tens of billions of dollars in 2009 to force doctors and hospitals into this. But much of the money, and from the story they say much of the money was wasted, and there are higher costs, more errors, no improvement in care, perhaps even worse care, and we're going to talk about those aspects. But they're saying much of that money was actually wasted.
Well, right, and I would think it depends on what you call waste, but there are so many practitioners. You see, there was a deadline, and if you didn't have this computer system running and functioning by, I'm just trying to remember, 2014, January 1, 2014, and then you had to start reporting, quote, meaningful use of it in order to get those full Medicare payments. And so doctors who are very busy people, and in little offices, large offices, and hospitals, right, they all had to start finding an electronic health record to buy. And electronic health records, EHRs, came out of the woodwork. I mean, because they had to buy them, right? And so there have been so many that have been purchased only to be gotten rid of. Some doctors are on their third EHR in trying to find one that works for them. And they weren't created to work for doctors. They were just created to do what the government said that they had to do. And because doctors had to buy them, the vendors, the ones who build them and develop them and sell them, they didn't have to make something that worked for the doctors. You know, it's not like your iPhone where, okay, I'm going to go get either an iPhone or I'm going to go get an Android. I'm going to get something that works for me, and they have to please you. They didn't have to please the doctors because the doctors had to buy their product.
Well, the Harvard Business Review is saying that health professionals are now in full backlash mode against these. So doctors are none too happy about this.
No, because it has done many things, right? It has cost them an arm and a leg. It's required them to get so many more staff, which has increased their own costs, which means they're paying for the system, right? And they're paying maybe to lease it, or maybe they're paying to put the data on the cloud, or they're paying to have somebody report all the data to the government that says that they have meaningfully used their electronic health record so that they can get fully paid by Medicare. So they're paying for all of those, and they have to have all this extra staff, and lots of them are now hiring what they call scribes, somebody who comes into the exam room with the doctor who doesn't have any credentials. They just have to be able to type. There's no credentials required for a scribe, and yet here's a third person in the exam room with the doctor, because that's the only way the doctor feels that he can look you in the eye, or she can, you know, touch you or get all the data and click all the buttons that need to be reported so that they can get fully paid. So this is really a command and control structure that was forcing doctors, and some doctors are just saying, you know what, I'm going to take the hit because it's costing me more money than the money that I'm losing to not be fully paid by Medicare. The whole plan here, though, was to take over the healthcare system through the electronic health record.
I understand professional burnout is happening, too?
Yes, and there have been a number of articles. There's a great article I read several years ago where they were just talking about burnout, and they doctors are they're leaving early, they're retiring early, they're trying to find new jobs because they didn't go into medicine to click boxes and to do what some clinical guideline told them they had to do to be fully paid. They spent all that time, they used all their brain power and all their money, and they got, you know, huge debt when they come out of medical school, only to be treated like workers on a conveyor belt and being told by others what to do, and then having to click all these boxes. They're spending twice as much time with the electronic health record than the patient. That's another study. And so a lot of them are just burned out. And this one article that I read, it didn't mention the electronic health record. Didn't even mention it. But there are like 200 comments, and almost all of them mentioned the electronic health record.
Wow. And I understand some are saying, that's enough of this, I'm retiring.
Yes. Early retirements. There's an interesting study. It's not correlated to the electronic health record, but I think you can say that there's a fair amount of that in there. But there is a study that the Physicians Foundation put out. They surveyed like 17,200 doctors, a little bit more than that. And 48% of them said that they are considering dropping hands-on medical practice in a variety of ways, either moving to concierge, where instead of 3,000 patients, they have only 300, or just getting out of clinical practice or retiring altogether.
Wow.
And the baby boomers are entering at 10,000 a day into Medicare, and yet half of the nation's doctors are thinking about getting out for the practice of medicine.
You said 10,000 a day?
That's how many people enter Medicare every day.
Folks, important issues we're talking about with Twyla Braze today from Citizens Council for Health Freedom, their website, cchfreedom.org. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking further at the concerns with the electronic health record, and we're going to even get into issues like patient privacy, and what about input error, and other areas of concern as well, and then also, what can you do about it? We'll be back in just 1 minute. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, geologist with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, if sedimentary rock is made up of sediments deposited by Noah's flood, where did the sediments come from?
Chris, it appears that before the flood, calcareous ooze made of tiny marine animals and secretions accumulated on the ocean bottom. Scooped up by the flood, they became today's limestone deposits. It also appears that the sandstone deposits came from created granitic rock, which eroded to yield the sand that are modern-day sandstones. Also, during the flood, intense volcanism occurred as the fountains of the Great Deep broke open, depositing huge quantities of volcanic ash. This became intermingled with other flood sediments to form a variety of rock types. Chris, I think the flood of Noah's Day is a very important concept which we must understand if we ever hope to understand the world around us. Let's develop a Back to Genesis way of thinking.
Thanks for tuning in to Back to Genesis.
This is Crosstalk, where we talk about the issues impacting us across this nation, and our topic today is dealing with that of electronic health records. Twyla Braes is with us from the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and the soon-to-be-released book, Big Brother in the Exam Room, The Dangerous Truth About Electronic Health Records. Twyla, you were talking about these scribes, and I saw one article that indicated that hospitals and clinics have literally hired tens of thousands of scribes to record, you know, these notes and make all these clicks into the electronic health records. So not only does this add to staff costs, but doesn't this also open the window for errors to be made? Where a medical doctor is not, you know, actually seeing that screen that's happening, or perhaps the person doing the clicks or inputting information is making their own interpretation, perhaps even different than what the doctor is thinking?
Well, I think that that's entirely possible. Some of the scribes are medical students in the making.
Okay.
Some are nurses, some are medical assistants, some aren't anything but, you know, good typists, right? And so I know that the doctors are supposed to look over what has been written and make sure that it's accurate, because after all, it is the doctor's license on the line. It is the doctor who would be sued, not the scribe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, indeed, that is one of the concerns, is that could be an error. It could be, I recall that in some cases the scribes are, they're bringing in more money because they're documenting all of this stuff and clicking all of the right buttons. So in some cases, it can be that the use of them actually costs the government more money, or the health plan more money, because of they're there, they have the time, they're being picky about everything that gets charged, and it can make the bill actually higher than it was when it was paper medical records.
I was looking at one article that was talking about the electronic health records, and they talked about a clinician was able to record a child's weight in kilograms rather than pounds, which they said could have led to some serious dangerous overdoses of medications that's measured by weight.
There is a case, I'm trying to think of his name, was it Pablo, or I think Pablo. Dr. Robert Wachter, Wachter, wrote a very long article about what happened in the case of this child. And this child was 16 and was supposed to get, I think, maybe one Sceptra. But because of what happened in the prescribing of it, or the pull-down menu or whatever, right, that child got 38 and a half pills of Sceptra at once.
Oh, my.
At once. And that child had, I believe, a seizure. The child lived, but it was difficult because this was such a major overdose. And that brings to mind another study, which shows that there are 22 new medication errors as a result of what's called computer physician, CPOE, computerized physician order entry. And one of the interesting things that they found in this study was that when it is written like a computer writes it, where it's just there, like black on white, and it's just written in, you know, lovely words, right? No scribbled hands that you have to figure out. It's just assumed to be truth more readily than if it is handwritten. It's not really looked at and scrutinized, and so it's just followed with less thinking than one would do with handwriting.
Uh-huh.
There is a certain, I don't know, there's a certain credibility to it being written in computerized form than being in hand form. It doesn't, so that's an interesting thing, because as a nurse, I think, you know, 38 and a half pills. Would I ever have given a patient 38 and a half pills? How exactly did that work? And Dr. Wachter talks a little bit about that, and I don't remember those details. But you have to engage your mind at all times. Mm-hmm. You just can't trust the computer.
Yeah. Is there any reporting mechanism in place to the government or some agency that when there are errors on the EHR that there's some kind of reporting?
There is an I can't remember what all the letters stand for, but it's called MAUD, and it is an adverse events reporting system that's voluntary, and there are some very interesting things that practitioners have written about different EHR systems, and I include at least one of those in my book. So there is, it's voluntary, but, you know, that's really not the crux of the issue. The crux of the issue is that this system was imposed to do what the government wanted it to do, mm-hmm. not to work for patient care. And so it's sort of like they'd now like to come and like lay fix after fix after fix to make this work right. But the thing is that the foundation is wrong. The foundation is wrong. And so everything else is just like putting Band-Aids on a bad foundation. And so, physicians should have the freedom to have an electronic record or not have one. And most of them should get themselves out of it and just take the financial hit. But unfortunately, if they've got contracts with health plans, for mm-hmm. instance, a lot of times the health plan, in order to see the health plan's patients, requires electronic reporting.
Twyla, what about data breaches? I mean, it seems, you know, not too much time goes by. We hear this happened to this company or this happened to that company. What about data breaches with the electronic health records?
Right. So there's it's informally called the HHS Wall of Shame. So if people look up HHS Wall of Shame, they would see all the breaches. And they're required by, I can't remember which law it was, that required this list to be created. And just recently, the Office of Civil Rights, which keeps the list, put only the last 2 years of breaches on the website. And I looked at it recently, and I believe there's something like 2,200 breaches since it started in 2009, I think. And that maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but there are breaches of millions of people, and there are breaches of, 1,000 people or 600 people. But all breaches that are under 500 people do not have to be reported. So this system does not include any of the smaller breaches unless someone wants to voluntarily report it. It only includes breaches that are 500 records breached or more. And it's just an ongoing breach problem. You can look up breach and you'll see a new breach probably once a week, if not more.
Wow. So, Twyla, I know one of the hallmarks of Citizens Council for Health Freedom is concerns about patient privacy, and I can only imagine that this whole EHR process puts patient privacy front and center.
Right, and, you know, some people, I can imagine some of your listeners thinking, well, I don't have anything in my records to hide, but I would just encourage you to rethink that, if anybody is thinking that. You don't even know what's in your records. I recently got an email just talking about what was in their record using apparently some kind of an algorithm or something that was in the record. It had them as likely having a diagnosis that they in no way, shape, or form had, and they had to sit there with their doctor and go through the records and delete the information that made the computer think that they had this diagnosis. So you might have diagnoses in your medical records that you don't know are there. You may have comments that you said to your doctor that you can't believe they actually wrote in there.
Mm-hmm.
You may have assessments that the doctor made that you don't know were made. And then there are codes. So there are codes that for even things like disheveled appearance or I can think of there's other very interesting kind of weird ones. There's the typical ones like, you know, broken this or broken that or, you know, a scar here or a surgery there or whatever. But there are these other very interesting codes where they can code the behavior of the person or the appearance of the person, and that becomes part of the medical record, the doctor's assessment of you in a code.
Where does this information go? Is it strictly between a patient and their doctor? Are there others that have access to it? Does the federal government have access to this?
So your listeners who have heard me before probably know that the so-called HIPAA privacy rule is not a privacy rule. It's a disclosure rule. And so the use of the word privacy was meant to deceive the American public. So all sorts of people have access to the information that is in your medical record that you might not even know exists in there. And the government is one of the national priority purposes for which data can be shared. The one thing about HIPAA is that it is permissive. So there are only two times where doctors and hospitals have to share information. One is with the federal government to monitor compliance with HIPAA, and the other is with the patient themselves. So those are the only two instances where they have to share. It's required. But the permitted sharing without patient consent is broad and deep and wide. And healthcare operations is one of the ways that it can be shared. And that's almost a 400-word definition that could have almost all of those words could have their own definitions for what they mean, because it's essentially a list of activities for which they can be shared. And so the government can get it. Whoever wants to give it to the government, they can get it when laws say that they can have it then, but they can have it without the laws because HIPAA permits them to get it if somebody wants to give it to them.
As you share all these things, Twyla, it gives one a feeling of helplessness. What can I do about this? It seems so large an issue, larger problem, the mandates upon doctors. And, yeah, doctors are standing up and they're rebelling against this right now, but is there anything that the average person across these United States can do?
So I'm just going to say probably two or three things. The first one is contact your state legislators and get them to pass a patient consent law. HIPAA is this federal floor. It doesn't have any privacy in it, but the one good thing it does say is that if a state passes a more restrictive, more privacy-protecting law, that is the law that has to be followed. That is the case right now in Minnesota, although our Chamber of Commerce, the Business Partnership, and all the Minnesota Hospital Association, all of these folks are trying to get rid of our law this session, and our organization is fighting to not have that happen. So we have one of the strongest state privacy laws in the nation, and every state can do that.
So would you have, like, model legislation that Citizens Council for Health Freedom can send out to individuals or to legislators?
Sure. Yeah, if they wish to contact us, we can send that out to them. It's actually very, very simple. It's sort of a notwithstanding any other law, we now require consent for the sharing of data. You know, that's almost as simple as it can be, mm-hmm. and it essentially bypasses all the other laws in the statute by putting that kind of a law in. So that's one thing. Another thing is when the book comes out, buy it and go to the last chapter. In the last chapter, I have actually put very specific action items from a whole range of ways of looking at it, for Congress, a separate list for state lawmakers, a separate list for practitioners, and a separate list for patients and citizens. And it's not a complete list. People can add to the list, but it's all sorts of ways to attack this problem. And when we look at privacy, we say he who holds the data makes the rules. Privacy is far less about protecting privacy than it is about protecting personal control over what happens in the exam room.
Twyla Bray is our guest here today on Crosstalk, cchfreedom.org. Let's open our lines. Maybe you've got questions about this. 800-733-9829. That's 800-733-9829. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
Attacks continue against the Bible. Some accuse the Bible of not being historically accurate. Some insist it's a book written by man filled with error. But did you know that archaeology continues to confirm what's written in Scripture? In the fully illustrated hardcover book, Evidence for the Bible, you are introduced to the world of biblical archaeology. Using full-color pictures and an easily read format, you will see that what has been dug up from the earth confirms the places and events from Scripture. Rulers and kings are documented, battles and their outcomes are confirmed, and details of prophetic utterances are precisely what are known to have happened. This book takes you on a fascinating journey during which the traveler never knows what may turn up with the next trial. It's hard to put this book down as one captivating page leads to another. Evidence for the Bible is available for a donation of $30. Call VCY America at 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Twyla Braze is with us. She's president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, also a registered nurse. She's very much concerned about patient privacy. She puts out daily commentary on the Health Freedom Minute. She is the author of a soon-to-be-released book, Big Brother in the Exam Room, The Dangerous Truth, about electronic health records. And that's our topic today, electronic health records. Taking your calls today at 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829. And one of the things that she stated is that there is a fix. And for each state to have their state legislature pass this, legislation on patient consent laws. Doesn't this happen in some regards, even with substance abuse treatment?
Misunderstood what you were saying there. Would you say it one more time?
I mentioned that you're trying to certainly encourage states to pass patient consent laws. Are there some laws in place already?
Sorry, I just missed that. So yes, at the federal level, there is a federal law that works for the entire country. That says if you receive substance abuse or treatment for substance abuse, that information cannot be shared with anyone without the patient's consent. So they decided, it's about 30 years old, they decided back then that if they allowed sharing for this very sensitive data, patients might not come in and get treated. And so they gave it privacy. But now there are two bills, one that has already passed in the Senate, and they call it Jesse's Law. It's passed in the Senate, but it hasn't passed in the House yet, and they're moving forward on it in the House. And so what we're trying to say here is that, no, this shouldn't pass. It's H.R. 3545 in the House, H.R. 3545. We're saying it shouldn't pass. Because what they said 30 years ago is true. If people know that their substance abuse treatment records are going to be shared with everyone, just like they are under HIPAA, they're not going to seek care until the last minute or they're desperate or, whatever. But not only that, everybody and everybody's medical records deserves that kind of treatment. So that kind of treatment with that kind of consent requirements, that is the model. It's even better than Minnesota's law because it's just like rock solid, doesn't go anywhere for no reason. And so that's what should happen. And so legislators around the country should hear that this should not happen, that these folks should not have all of their substance abuse treatment information shared with hospitals and third parties who can use it for all sorts of other purposes, that the patients have no idea what's happening to it.
Hmm. Let's go to the phone lines. Are packed right now. Mary's calling from Central Wisconsin. You're on the air, Mary.
Thank you so much. For Twyla, I had a very unusual, horrible situation. My husband was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease, very rare, known as Pick's disease. Somehow, some way, all his medical records ended up from Wisconsin out in California, and it took me months, even years, to try and straighten it out. I had to have POA for my husband because he was terminal. And perhaps you could share with any of your listeners how to go about retrieving records that have been so messed up. It even came down to medicines being given him that were actually killing him. How does one stop this horror?
See, this is part of the problem with the electronic record system, because particularly because the whole plan with the electronic health record is not only that it would sit there in your doctor's office, right, and report data to the federal government, but also that it would be hooked up to a grid. It's called the National Health Information Network, which is being built, which has a new name now called the eHealth Exchange. And this is a place where everybody, all of these entities from California to New York, would all be all hooked up onto this system, and under HIPAA, they can just share the data nearly willy-nilly, not quite, but almost willy-nilly. And so once the data is shared...
Is that a medical term, willy-nilly?
No.
Okay.
Maybe it's a Midwest term.
Okay.
And so once the data is shared, it's very difficult to get it out. You know, when, as a nurse, when we wrote down somebody's medication, if we made an error, we had to cross a line through it, and that error stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was clear that that medication wasn't there. But if you go to your doctor's office now, they'll tell you a list of medications that you're apparently on, but you haven't been on them for maybe months or years. They
right.
just they never took them off, and so they don't actually know what your situation is now. And so when you're talking about trying to get medical records that are accurate and true. Once, I mean, it's just very difficult. That's all I can say. It's very, very difficult, and the information goes around, and other people get hold of it, and it gets into their data systems, not just on the exchange, right, but into these third parties that are the business associates of the hospitals and the health plans and the clinics, and it gets in their data systems. It becomes part of, some of it is sold. Sold to data aggregators, anonymized data, but today there's no data that's really anonymized. You can figure it out by matching up with another public database mm-hmm. and figure out who most of those people are. So I'm sorry to tell you, very difficult.
Very difficult, and it would be Mary's persistence to keep fighting it.
We yeah. tried, but there's so much corruption out there. We legally, we couldn't get anywhere. He died, and... never got any resolve. It just put me through horror.
I'm so sorry, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. And, Twyla, that's the tragedy of the very issue we're talking about here today.
Yes, and there are other tragedies, like somebody else's data getting in her husband's medical record. That's possible, too. There'll be a story of that in the several stories of that in the book where the doctor was saying the information about the patient, and the patient's looking at the doctor like, you know, that's not me. That's not me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to anonymous caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I have a question for Twyla. Thank you for taking my call. My husband will be retiring in 1 month or 2 months, and I don't want to go under Obamacare, and I don't know where else to go because I only need it for 11 months. Is there any way to find out some other kind of insurance?
Well,
is this where the cost sharing may come in, the medical sharing?
Right. There, you can get coverage off the exchange because Obamacare is when you go into the exchange. And if you have options off the exchange, you can try to have those options. But the other thing, yes, is the health sharing organizations. And if you go to our website, cchfreedom.org, and just look on the right-hand side, there's a rotating thing, and one of them is for health sharing or medical sharing. I can't remember which one we have it saying, but there are six organizations that you could choose from, and you could just sign up with them and start participating in that. And it may be so pleasant. I know that at least one of them, I think it's Samaritan, there might be some other ones, too, that allow you to continue past Medicare age if you wish to. So that's an opportunity. You might want to try that.
There was also another thing that when they were doing these digital records, they were asking me what my religion was. Do I have to give them that information?
Actually, you don't have to give them any information except whatever you want shared with your doctor. And I will tell all the listeners now that when you go into the doctor's office and they have a questionnaire, if it's written, it's easier. You just don't fill it out, right? But if it's on a pad, an electronic pad, and you get to a question that you do not want to do and it won't let you go any further, just take it up and say, I'm not answering this. Simple as that.
They were on the computer.
And then they won't like it, but but they can figure out ways to get beyond that. And you can say, you know, I'm not going to answer the rest of this. I don't feel like I need to answer these questions about me. I'll answer what the doctor needs to know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take control of that. They're gathering data for themselves, for profiling, for
But you don't
reporting.
Have to answer those
you
questions, ma'am.
I don't.
No.
Okay.
Thank you for the call. Catherine is calling next. You're on the air, Catherine.
Good afternoon. My call is in regard to coding. And I'm aware that I'm on Medicare, and I'm aware that Medicare offers a physical exam for no charge once a year. However, when I go into my doctor and all of a sudden she starts asking me about my blood pressure or my thyroid condition, that's not regarded as a Medicare visit anymore. It's all of a sudden regarded as a doctor's visit. And so my free Medicare checkup turned out to be $125 because when I called records at our facility, they said, well, it's because the doctor puts the coding in, and every time you talk about a problem that you might have, you get charged for it. What happened to the days when you went into a doctor's office and your doctor's appointment charge was $125 and you could talk to her about anything?
You are talking about the Affordable Care Act and the annual wellness visit.
Yes.
The annual wellness visit is not considered a physical exam, and I think the payment for that is that the doctors get to do an annual wellness visit, and they do not charge you for an annual wellness visit. I think the payment starts at something like maybe it's a little over $100 that they receive from Medicare for that. Their whole plan is to get every person in and get a cognitive test on every person and get, you know, it's sort of like, I call it an inspection. but as soon as it starts to become a physical exam, and they should tell you that. They should say, you're here for your Medicare annual wellness visit, which is not a physical exam, and there are only certain things that we can talk about. And if we only talk about those certain things, then you won't be charged. If you want to talk about anything else, you need to make a separate appointment to have a physical. And see, this is what they really haven't bothered to tell people, is it's not a physical. It's not really there for you. It's something Medicare wants. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the law, Medicare says you have to go in. But there's no teeth in it, right? There's nothing that they're not going to, you know, penalize you or take part of your tax refund away or anything like that. But the law is actually says you have to go in for this inspection. Mm. And that's what they do not make clear to seniors. So seniors think they're in there for, you know, an annual physical or an annual, you know, something annual, like a real doctor's visit. But it's not really a real doctor's visit.
Well, I certainly wasn't informed about that, and I was a little angry about it. So in the future, I will listen to what you say, and I will go into the doctor when I need to.
Catherine, thank you for your call here today.
You're welcome.
Ronald is next. Go ahead, Ronald. You're on the air.
I was wondering about this situation where these scribes interrupting with the
right
personal relationship with the doctor as a patient. And to me, it seemed like it was more government getting control. And maybe it's good in a way because something is wrong. You have it written, but on the other hand, it can be used more for government control.
So the scribes have sort of come out of the woodwork, as it were, because physicians having to do all this reporting at the same and recording at the same time that they're seeing the patient have become frustrated because they went, you know, to have a relationship with the patient and they want to look at the patient and they want to touch the patient and the computer is getting in the way, and some patients would complain that they're only seeing the back of the doctor's head. There's a story about one child drawing a picture in the exam room and showing the doctor with his back to the child's mom or whatever.
Mm.
And so this just came out of the woodwork in order to deal with the frustration of physicians.
Tell you what, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Crosstalk.
For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewradio.com. One of the greatest threats facing the true church today is the mainstreaming of socialism. Sadly, many people are unaware
that the leading and most popular speakers within conservative circles of evangelicalism, quote conservative, are indeed for redistribution of wealth. Many of these people include Tim Keller from the New York area. Tim Keller has a book entitled Generous Justice. It really should have been called Social Justice. And in fact, he says, instead of using the term social justice or redistribution of wealth, he likes to use the word reweaving a community. Some of the biggest evangelical leaders today are now saying it is the responsibility of Christians to redistribute the wealth. Be on guard for the rise of socialism among the thinking of your young people.
We're discussing the electronic health records today here on Crosstalk. Twyla Braes, folks, quite an authority on the issue as she has examined and researched and been involved in this battle for years and years, and a warning today here on Crosstalk. We're going back to, by the way, the website is cchfreedom.org, cchfreedom.org. Right back to the lines. Al has been holding the longest from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. You're on the air. Hello, Al.
Al?
Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Jim. Twyla, I've been a recipient of VA medical care for 15 years, and it's been satisfactory. And my question is, how secure are my medical records with the U.S. Veterans Administration? Thank you.
Thank you.
No electronic medical records are secure, and there are people who want everybody to put the data in the cloud so that it's more readily accessible to outsiders. And although some people say it's secure in there, I don't believe it. The government is planning to go to the cloud to try and get data out of the electronic health records. What I will say about and then there's just breaches, and there's one other thing I'm just slipped out of my brain here that I can't remember. But what I can say is that the VA is working towards putting them in a brand new system. I believe it's with the Cerner EHR. But there's no computerized medical record that is as safe as a paper medical record, because, of course, you have to go in and pull out the thing before you can get any of the data in a paper record. But in an electronic health record, you just have to figure out the way in. You can, you know, download a whole bunch and take them out the office with you if you happen to be one of those employees who wants to use them to sell the data for medical ID theft. You know, clearly, with all of these breaches happening, you can tell it's not a secure system.
Barbara is calling from Trempealeau. You're on the air, Barbara.
Yes. Hello, and I just barely turned this on. I've been shoveling snow. But praise the Lord that you're all there, because there's so many people like myself that are unaware of these things. And God bless you for all of your endeavors, because we need to know these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't say thank you enough.
Did you have a question for Twyla today, Barbara?
No, I just want to thank all of you.
Great. Thank you, Barbara.
Shalom.
Appreciate your call. Thank you. We have Richard calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Richard, you're on the air.
All right. Thank you. I was hearing your conversation, and I was getting phone calls. A lot of people have seen this on TV about a back brace, knee brace. You can get it. Call this number. I haven't called nobody, but I'm always getting solicitations from knee braces, back braces, and everything else. I called my pharmacy and asked them, are you sharing my records? They said, oh, certainly not. We don't do that. Called my doctor's office. No, we don't do that. Called the hospital. No, we don't do that. But you guys are answering the same the questions that I had, that it's out there and without my permission.
Well, and there's a different way, too, that hospitals and pharmacies, and it's actually been in the news very recently about the pharmacies, is that what HIPAA allows when it comes to marketing is it allows third parties to come to the hospital. Let's just say you were to the hospital for something having to do with your knee or whatever, right? This is an example. And HIPAA allows a third party who would like to sell you a brace for a knee to come to the hospital and say, would you be willing, we'll pay you, would you be willing to send this advertisement out to all of your patients who have received treatment for their knees? And that way the hospital keeps the data the third party who wants to sell this thing to you does not get your information, but the hospital, sends their brochure to you. And so that could be happening both through the pharmacy, to the hospital, the clinic, is they can be the one that send out the advertisement on behalf of the one who wants to sell it to you.
Right, but everybody denied it. Everybody was innocent. And I said, no, somebody's selling my information.
But see, they're not sharing your information. They're keeping it for themselves. They're keeping it for themselves, and they are doing the mailing themselves. They're not sharing your information with those companies that you're talking about, but they're taking the money from those companies, using their address book, and taking the company's product and sending it to you. But they have not shared it outside of the hospital.
That's
they're
using the technical term of what sharing means,
yeah.
Richard.
Well, yeah, to me, it's the same thing, isn't
you're
it?
You're right.
It's no matter how you... You know, you can call a tree a cactus or something else, but it's still a tree.
You're right.
No matter what.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Appreciate the call. And our final call is coming from Zanesville, Ohio. And Maureen, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Boy, this is quite a program of information. But what would happen if you decided not to sign one of those HIPAA forms? I've signed dozens and dozens over the past few years for myself and my husband. And can you not just simply not sign one?
So let me first say.
Thanks for the question.
Yes. Remember this link, HIPAAHurtMe.org, HIPAAHurtMe.org, HIPAA, HurtMe.org, two A's, one P. Because that's where we take stories of what happens when you refuse to sign the HIPAA form. You do not have to sign the HIPAA form. Signing the HIPAA form does not stop them from sharing your information. Signing the HIPAA form, if you look at it very carefully, or if you look at that line on a regular consent form and it says, I acknowledge that I have received the notice of privacy practices, if you refuse to sign that or you cross that out on the consent form or you refuse to sign the special HIPAA form, however they do it, the only thing that you're refusing to do is to acknowledge that you have seen the notice of privacy practices. Whether you sign or you don't sign doesn't mean that they can't share your information. HIPAA allows them to share your information. Getting you to sign that form is how they convince people that you have privacy when you have none. So it should really be called a notice of disclosure practices, because if you looked at it, that's exactly what it would show, is everywhere that they can share your data without your consent. So, yes, try not signing that form and then tell us the story of what happened. Some people are refused access to care. Some people call us at the doctor's office every once in a while that happens and say, can you talk to this person here? They won't let me in. And I'm telling them that the federal law lets me not sign. And the federal law, the only thing the federal law says is that they have to make a good faith effort to get you to sign the form.
We're out of time.
The federal government says you don't have to sign it.
Thank you, Maureen. We are out of time on the broadcast. And, folks, you may want to follow up further with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And, Twyla, the best way to contact your organization?
They can go to the website, cchfreedom.org. It includes an email at the bottom, cchfreedom.org, or call us at 651-646-8935.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.